Chapter 4: A New Kind of Creativity. The next several months had been quite eventful for the now three best friends. But there was only a little opportunity for changing things. It was about Amelia, Pete, and David learning the ropes at the State Department. Day after day, they were involved with meetings and forming staff structure. It was all about learning how to adjust with each other to their individual working and leadership tasks and personalities, and establishing work cadences. It became apparent that leading a political organization was much more diverse than being the head of a corporate entity. It was also much more difficult for Amelia. After President John Block's inauguration, the new cabinet went into full swing. Each cabinet head was nearly overwhelmed with learning what the new president expected of them and their departments, and then implementing his marching orders to the various layers of authority from the top to the bottom of the respective organizational charts. Amelia was familiar with an organizational structure and the control of one, as she had created and led a large corporation and ran a governmental administration. She was also familiar with the complexities and challenges inherent in those structures. But she was beginning to see and understand the differences between those entities and the one she was involved in now. Corporations were saturated in complexities and problems with growth or decline issues, whereas the State Department needed to focus on the difficulties of crises every day and all day. It was one crisis after another. She knew about this fact, but was unaware of what it meant to be in control of it. An analogy to this situation is like holding the reins of a runaway stallion on a craggy and steep mountaintop trail. Most of the area to traverse was out of your control, and you have to trust the horse. But the horse needs a steady hand on the reins to go to the required location decided by the rider. It takes both of them to make it safely down the mountainside. At first, Amelia, like most others, was impressed that she had a Boeing C-32 assigned to her because of the excessive traveling she had to do during her tenure as Secretary of State. The Secretary of State holds one of the most critical positions in the U.S. government. As the senior member of the President's cabinet, Amelia would carry out the President's foreign policy decisions. She would also advise the President on various issues of international concerns to our nation. This management level requires continuous meetings with foreign leaders and dignitaries in their countries or within the United States when they are there. However, on the point of the Secretary's plane, she found that her oversight corp company jets were far more to her liking. The C-32 government jet must be more office-like to suit her, and too many people on board demanded her time and input. Other passengers paid much less deference to Amelia on her oversight jets, and a long journey on them was much more like traveling super first class on a commercial plane. Shortly after establishing herself in the State Department, she set up a personal covert meeting policy with Pete and David. They secretly referred to themselves as the bossy trio during private meetings between them. She wanted lower-ranking senior staff to be involved in the planning eventually. Still, she also wanted the first meetings to be attended by Pete, David, and her alone before involving other staff. Usually, she held these formative meetings at home, so the rest of the staff was unaware of them before the State Department's active internal staff planning began. Pete and David, who were now living together, would stay at her house during those meetings, as these get-togethers tended to be lengthy and complex. She kept only two Secret Service agents in her residence. The President wanted her to have more because of her global profile, but she said two would be sufficient at home. Her Potomac home was also safe because of the security facilities built into it. When she traveled, especially out of the country, the number of agents would increase to whatever the head of the Secret Service determined was needed. The trio's first major crisis within the first year was illegal immigration at the southern border of the country. Amelia was surprised to learn that immigration was a significant purview of the State Department. Her previous outlook was that the Immigration Department and Department of Homeland Security dominated that. Still, in actuality, the State Department had oversight about our borders. It took a lot of work for the State Department to dominate the physical activities occurring there and manipulate a resolution of the problem. The stress was long-standing, and it was quickly getting worse. What made it even more frustrating was that the House of Representatives was hostile to the President's executive branch and the Senate membership. Therefore, the president and his cabinet became the enemy in almost all cases that made the news cycles. The House controls appropriations, and that will determine where, when, and how the representatives distribute the money to get things done. In this case, with immigration, attempting to resolve that problem was significantly costly. Over the decades, immigration has been the piñata of politics. Both major parties refused to solve the problems of immigration, even when they could. Both political parties found that they could use this piñata to their advantage by blaming the other party for the immigration problems. Both parties used this to acquire or deflect voters during an election. It was a sad affair. Amelia called for the first of the trio bosses' covert meetings at her home to discuss and determine what solutions they could come up with among themselves. If they did, then Amelia would request personal contact with President Block to get his approval or denial for a plan. Following that and approval from the president, they would work with the appropriate State Department staff groups to structure a plan of action. As usual, David started with an analysis of the immigration crisis. He immediately summed up the following details. A lot of what we define as the immigration problem stems from the fact that we have entirely too many people wanting to enter the United States, particularly on the southern border, and from Central and South America. Politicians in both major parties use this situation as a tool to debase the other party, which is unhealthy for the nation. We need a well-thought-out solution for this many immigrants. Even if they were all eligible to become permanent residents, immigrants, green card holders, or resident aliens. Gaining immigrant status can be excessively lengthy. Complex processes requires close consultation with numerous immigration attorneys. There are different categories of people seeking legal status in the United States. These include residents and non-residents, immigrants and non-immigrants, asylum and refugees, and documented and undocumented. Many immigrants already legally residing in the United States have green cards or permanent visas. An individual with a green card can eventually seek to become a United States citizen. David stopped at this point, and Pete offered some comments. That is a good summation, David. Now, we must implement a plan to resolve the significant points of this complicated subject. And I think we can just about rule out being able to determine the political aspect of it. What do you think? Amelia said. We have to work on something to resolve the impasse both political parties have created, but this would have to be considered a long-game solution. We must start to work on a plan where the party in power, which would be us, starts the ball rolling in creating a political playbook that would take the immigration discussion out of the political arena. But I agree with you, Pete, that a political solution cannot be the first foray into resolving this problem. The different political tribes will never work together for a political solution. At least not at this time. David then directed to Amelia. What is the first major aspect of this problem or problem that needs to be solved? She responded. It is the fact that entirely too many aliens are arriving at our borders at almost the same time. The border crossings strain local, regional, state, and federal control points, providing the political rabble-rousers with fodder to stir up various political pressure groups. Immigration is in United States' Achilles heel, constantly being attacked by the dueling politicians. It's difficult to resolve this quickly, but we must attempt to do that as a first step in the long-game solution. Pete then suggested, I do have a suggestion that we could consider that will, if implemented, possibly solve many of the current influx problems, and that would quite likely speed up your long-game solution. This suggestion is also complicated to enact due to the political flashbacks from every direction, which is why it hasn't been accomplished yet. But it has multiple advantages if arranged and implemented before the opposition knows it. Pete hesitated, pulled out some of his notes, and read. Venezuelans became the largest nationality group arrested for illegally crossing the U.S. border, replacing Mexicans for the first time on record this year, according to figures recently released. Immigration law does allow individuals to apply for asylum in the United States if they are escaping their countries and seeking protection based on persecution, or perhaps even a well-founded fear of persecution because of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Amelia questioned Pete's overly complete breakdown of this immigration description. What's with the detail here, Pete? David and I are aware of all this. Of course you are, but I can't present a solution without creating the preamble. Okay? Amelia and David responded that they understood, so Pete continued. The first step is to alleviate the political pressure. It will be necessary to stop the ever-expanding buildup of immigrant tsunamis on the border. This could be done by processing all immigrants faster and determining the eligibility of an asylum candidate. I suggest that you stop having the individual courts process each immigrant one by one. This could be accomplished by converting the due diligence of each request to an artificial intelligence resolution. David could come up with an AI methodology system pretty quickly. Of course, the courts or others could challenge a case here and there and force the courts themselves to oversee the challenge. Still, it is unlikely that the AI system might not be more correct regarding an applicant's eligibility than the current bureaucratic system. Pete looked at the others. Comments, please. David answered first. It makes sense to me. As Pete suggests, the technology already exists, so it would be possible to put an AI system to work quickly. The current situation with immigrants being held in detention facilities or sent out into society with no proper papers does not benefit the country. The faster we get an approved immigrant into the workforce, the better we all are. Their labor offering is desperately needed throughout the country as it always has been, whether the labor was Irish, Italian, Latin, etc. Also, when a person is working, taxes are paid, and everyone benefits. Additionally, employed workers are less likely to break the law by stealing to eat and to support their families. I would also suggest creating a worker integration department that U.S. companies can access to acquire the necessary labor when they need it quickly. Amelia now added her opinion. These ideas are excellent, and I will be fine getting this approved by the president. I suggest we keep the idea from the public until it is approved by the appropriate state staff and placed in the works for implementation. No matter how good a solution is, the opposition will attempt to cripple it. So we need to create a policy that adversaries will have a problem penetrating during its implementation. She then continued and Pete, you mentioned that the Venezuelans were arrested well over 50,000 times by the Border Patrol last year. Venezuela represents an ever-increasing percentage of asylum seekers than any other country. I have an idea that may assist in taking those large numbers away and greatly simplify the border problem. David interjected. If you have a solution for that problem, Amelia, it would virtually solve the immigration problem, or at least soften it. What do you have in mind? She answered. Unfortunately, nothing straightforward. But often perfect solutions to a significant problem never are. I have met the present and previous presidents of Venezuela because of my last jobs as CEO of Oversight Corp and administrator of USAID. Nothing adverse ever occurred between me and those presidents during our activities together. I plan on renewing old acquaintances with the current president of Venezuela to see if we can establish acceptable relationships between the United States and Venezuela. If that is possible, we would have two significant benefits that would occur to our State Department and benefit our particular immigration stresses. Venezuela has a large and perhaps one of the largest oil reserves in the world, and is operating far below capacity. A return to global participation would also assist in lowering the cost of oil everywhere, benefiting them and our current inflation problems. Fully participating on the world stage would also increase their employment requirements, thereby stopping the number of Venezuelans coming to us. Pete asked, "What would John say about this?" I haven't heard the president make an open statement of opinion on removing the sanctions against them. Obviously, Amelia responded. I have discussed this with him, and know that he will support this, and take the lead in proposing the cessation of the United States sanctions once I have found out whether Venezuela will agree to our new terms. But what do you two think of considering this rapprochement concept? Both men raised their thumbs to indicate their approval. The bossy trio then spent the rest of the evening on a more relaxed cadence, but continued to smooth out some new ideas and modify them where needed before their staff leaders converted them into a workable calls to action by the State Department. Within the next 2 weeks, Amelia met with the president to apprise him of their new planning for government immigration reform. She also indicated her intention to negotiate with the Venezuelan government to normalize their mutual U.S./Venezuelan relationships and assist the Venezuelans in organizing internal and external management support to expand and market their oil production and expansion planning. President Bloch warned Emilia that his national intelligence director had warned him that any move to repair Venezuelan affairs, mainly to restore its oil industry, would meet with significant danger from various forces desirous of maintaining the status quo. He warned Emilia that she might be placing herself in harm's way by spearheading this plan. She told him she was aware of proceeding with a Venezuelan solution and producing dangerous situations. She would keep that possible threat in mind. The danger was clear and present in much of what the State Department was involved in, and she couldn't let it dictate her actions. She unleashed her departments with the president's blessing to plan and implement the activities. She spent the next 2 months putting a lot of air miles on the State Department's jet. She'd been to France twice and England 3 times. Of course, she flew to Venezuela twice and hosted 7 meetings in her offices with Venezuelan government officials. Things were going very well with Venezuela. They wanted to repair their alliance with the United States but needed to know how to initiate such an alliance. Who knew?